I wanted to start with one thing that doesn't really have to do much with the topic of H2 and this kind of thing, namely this remark that Kieron used in a vast exaggeration to draw a huge crowd today, which didn't quite succeed. So, since this week was largely on computational points, I wanted to make one remark which refers to molecular dynamics type calculations, Carparinello. So those of you who have been involved in this kind of simulations, you know that for very large systems, the time-limiting step is actually the orthogonalization of the orbitals. So that goes like n to the third, and there's, from what the specialists tell me, very little one can do about it. Now this has a relatively small prefactor, so this n to the third behavior takes over only for very large systems. But now one really gets into the regime where this plays a role. Previously it didn't play much of a role. And the point, so these calculations, the essence is you propagate classical nuclei, and simultaneously the ground state Cohn-Sham equation. And what I would like to suggest is to propagate classical nuclei, but in parallel not the ground state Cohn-Sham equation, but rather the time-dependent Cohn-Sham equation. And the reason is, of course, physically for ground state type problems, the result will be the same, but it's a purely numerical point that the scaling is better. So if you have a time propagation, the scaling is n squared, and if you use a unitary time propagation algorithm, the orbitals stay orthogonal. Right? There's no orthogonalization step involved. It just doesn't appear. So for really very, very large systems, I would claim this should be a huge advantage. Well, that is certainly an issue. That depends on the particular time propagation algorithm that you use. And one absolutely essential point is to use a unitary algorithm. Otherwise, very quickly your norm of the time-dependent orbital will blow up. But there are many. And there are some algorithms which I think are particularly suitable for this kind of thing, which are highly accurate. So you need relatively large, only large time steps to get nevertheless a good accuracy. So those algorithms do exist. Of course, you cannot use this when you have a laser field with a high frequency, then the frequency determines your time step. But that's not the kind of that's not the thing that we're discussing here.
Yeah. How large time steps in practice? What are the experiences of that?
Well, this, as I said, depends strongly on the algorithm you use. If you use the so-called Magnus propagators, so with those you get you can use huge time steps. It really makes a difference of 100 or so, factor 100 in the time step.
Hmm? No.
It's no. That is for situations where you really have strong or stronger time dependence in the. But here you don't. So.
Because if it's 0.1 microseconds, it's competitive.
Oh, I think it would even be larger.
Larger, 1 femtosecond, 1.5 femtosecond.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly what I mean.
I mean, then it's really competitive because
you want to do it more. Yeah? Could it be an issue
with temperature or
something? Temperature. Okay. Especially about the method that allows you to take big time scales.
You don't have a fast time from the preparation.
The physics of this application.
So physics of this particular, yeah.
No, there's a physical application in mind. And linearity is enforced by hand or the algorithm?
By the algorithm.
Already, automatically.
I mean, the exact propagation would be this time propagation operator acting on the wave function at time t. And the time propagation operator is e to the I Hamiltonian times t. And
exactly the exponent.
Yes, so you have to approximate this e to the I hd, but you have to, you cannot write it as 1 plus I delta h delta t. So this you cannot do because that's not unitary. But there's many ways of doing it. I mean, the most popular ones are so-called split operator techniques. That relies on fast Fourier transforms. So what you have essentially is e to the I h bar. It's over h bar, but we don't need that here. Delta t, and h is kinetic energy plus potential, so it's Kronchamp Hamiltonian. And so we can write this as e to the minus I t delta t over 2 e to the minus I v delta t e to the minus I, and then kinetic energy again delta t over 2 plus terms of order delta t to the third, right? So you just approximate this exponential by this. It's correct to this order, but here you see those are all unitarity conserving expressions, right? So it's manifestly unitary. And then the way you do it, you so let's call that whole thing here, let's call that U, and your wave function phi at t plus delta t is essentially given by acting with U on phi at time t. And then we approximate U by this, right? And then what is done is, so this we start in real space. The first part of calculation is a Fourier transform, a fast Fourier transform to phi of k and t. Then we act with this e to the minus I t delta t over 2. And this, since it's a momentum space wave function, is just k squared over 2, right? So it's just a product, it's trivial. So this leads to, let's call it phi tilde of k and t. This we Fourier transform again to get a phi tilde at r and t. Right. Then on this we act with this guy, e to the minus I v of r delta t. This gives us phi double tilde of RMT, then we fast Fourier transform again with phi double tilde of KMT. Then we act with this, so you see how it goes, right? And it's all those fast Fourier transforms, and in the end we have the time propagated wave function. So this is one possibility. Other possibility is the Crank-Nicholson, which is this fractional representation of the exponential here, something like what is it, 1 minus I delta t h delta t over 2 1 plus, which is also unit territory. So that there's many ways. But if you want particularly long time steps, the algorithm to use is so-called Magnus propagators, which are more tricky. So that's a suggestion, which I think should be a huge gain for very large systems. In addition, I mean, it parallelizes much more nicely.
Absolutely. All this, I still don't understand how the time step gets so large, because I mean, the simple fact that the electron mass is small would intuitively seem to get you in the outer second scale, which is typically quoted by everybody that starts with
Yeah, I know.
This is ground zero.
No, there's two aspects of it. I mean, on one hand, there is really physically is nothing happening. And the other aspect is magic of these Magnus propagators. It really allows you to take large time steps.
So you can actually propagate through any oscillation.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, that was the point that I wanted to make, independent of the main topic of the afternoon. Yes. I haven't thought about that, to be honest.
Because it was so stupid.
No.
That's a good one.
Yeah, well, this is a more general question to any to the method of quantum classical propagation schemes. And there the experience is, if you do Ehrenfest dynamics, so the forces on the nuclei are determined by the electronic wave functions, you get some exchange of energy, but it's not the right one. So in particular, you find that the systems don't properly thermalize.
Okay.
So that is a problem. Okay. Bye, Anne. Let's sing together again.
Yes. I will go home and check out what time it is.
All right. Now that's the next step.
You haven't seen them on YouTube
yet. Okay.
Okay,
so this is then another topic. H2, or actually I'm not saying much about H2, but rather on H2 plus. But I'll start a little bit with H2. It's just something that I've kept thinking about for years without much result. But, let's put it back. You all know the problem. That is general wisdom. If you do H2 with Hartree-Fock, right, you get a curve which for large R is totally wrong. These energies are much too high.
This is tricky.
Hmm?
This is tricky.
with spin restricted Hartree Fock. So the point is, and I was going to discuss that in detail. So the for each fixed internuclear separation, the we know from group theory that the ground state should be a spin singlet, and in Hartree Fock you can, as you know, enforce that by occupying one and the same molecular orbital. One will spin up, one will spin down, and then, and here we multiply that with a singlet spin wave function. So that's by construction at each fixed internuclear separation your Hartree Fock solution, and you just do a Hartree Fock calculation for this one orbital. And then you get this, which is totally wrong. And one perfectly understands why this is, and then one can kind of decompose this as a left nucleus and the right nucleus contribution. This is in all the quantum chemistry books, and if one works it out, one gets these ionic contributions and some contribution that both electrons sit on one nucleus and both electrons sit on the other, and they give a too high energy. So that's physically where this comes from. That's all standard knowledge. We also know what for large R the proper solution is. That's the Heitner-London wave function. Okay. Now the other possibility that people have done is to do spin unrestricted Hartree Fock. So you allow the two orbitals to have different spin, and then there's this so-called Coulson-Fisher point at a particular internuclear separation. The spin polarized solution has a lower energy in Hartree Fock, so this has this structure. If you plot the spin magnetization, it goes up on one and goes down on the other, so spin magnetization is not zero, so you have the wrong spin symmetry of your solution. But the energy is decent then. And it's the same story if you do LDA, GGA. There's no difference. This is a problem that both Hartree Fock and all these simple functionals, let's say, have in common. So I thought for a long time, well, basically this is perfect, right? Having this spin polarized solution. Because if you think of the real world, well, we assume exact eigenfunctions at any given distance, but an exact eigenfunction is hardly ever realized in nature, right? Nature is time dependent. And you start with some state which, due to some perturbations, is not a perfect eigenstate. And as soon as it's not a perfect eigenstate and you propagate in time, you have some contributions of each of these two possibilities. And then what you find is that the system will oscillate. Right? You will oscillate between this one, forth and back. Now you could argue, well, what is wrong about it? Long-time average of these oscillations then give you the spin unpolarized situation. But let's say on the lifetime of a postdoc you are in this situation, and that's fine. So the physics is really this situation, I thought for a while.
In a dissociation limit, this or this, they should be degenerate.
Yeah, they're all degenerate. Yeah.
So
there's no
oscillation
if they're
degenerate. The oscillation
gives you its energy difference. Yeah, in the infinity limit, yes. Then they are degenerate. At any finite, and this Coulson-Fisher point is very finite. It's not really far.
But the question is, what happens at that transition point? I think it's multiple transition points there.
Yeah, at the point itself, that is tricky. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. But you see, what I was arguing before is, well, on a very long time scale, such a spin polarized solution is actually what life is. But not quite true. You have to remember that there are certain situations where, physical situations, where it's actually essential to have an exact single state. Right? And that's the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen experiment. Right? So it depends on experiment. I think the argument that I gave before, that this is actually for a long time the right solution, is in a way correct. But if you do other kinds of experiments, like Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen experiment, then it's essential to have an exact singlet state. And this gives you these long-range correlations, which in fact you can measure. So that tells you there's a lot of aspects to this problem. But what I would like to kind of focus on in what I'm going to show is this aspect of tunneling. So these oscillations that you get on a certain time scale that depends on the internuclear separation. And we investigated that in the context of H2+, and in the context of the charge transfer problem that linear response TDDFT has. So this is another well-known problem that is related to this other problem. So let me start with that one. So I will first talk about this charge transfer problem in linear response TDDFT, and then I'm going to show you this time propagation picture.
There's a quiz.
There's a quiz for you. Yes. You're not allowed to play because you know the answer. Where's the pointer?
No, I think we lost it.
You lost it.
There's
a laser one. Okay.
That one.
Okay, so the charge transfer problem in linear response TDDFT. So we imagine a limiting case where, let's think of it, of two atoms, A and B, separated by a large distance, and in spite of this being 1 meter, we consider this system as one. Yeah? Our system is the one that consists of these two atoms. And then we look at the excitation spectrum, and one of the possible excitations that this two-atom system has is we take one electron from this atom and put it to the other. So then the excitation energy in this large R limit is very easy to calculate. So first, one way of viewing this is we have to move the electron that is on atom A to infinity. That requires the ionization potential of atom A. And then we move it back from infinity to the atom B. And the energy associated with that is the electron affinity of atom B. But then we immediately realize we have created a hole here and a particle here, and there is an electrostatic interaction, and that's a dominant term in this interaction between the particle and hole. And that's written down here. So if this is the orbital associated with the HOMO from which the electron is removed, and phi b, the next orbital, the LUMO of atom B here, then this should be the electrostatic interaction. Okay, then in the DFT context, there's one aspect to be mentioned immediately. Suppose we had the exact functional, then the ionization potential here would be the exact HOMO, while the LUMO of this atom would not be the electron affinity, but rather we have to add the discontinuity of the exchange correlation potential. Okay, but this then gives you a right formula for that limit, for this limiting situation. And you see one thing immediately, this term here behaves like 1 over capital R. Right? It's the Coulomb interaction between this particle and hole. If you write this out, put in exponentials, some generic orbitals here, it's obvious. It's the interaction of the particle and the hole. It has to behave like 1 over the distance between the two. If you do, then with your favorite LDA, GGA functional, a TDDFT calculation for this situation, you find that this behavior of 1 over R, that is coming from this term, is missed. TDDFT doesn't get that. And this is called the charge transfer excitation problem of TDDFT. And it's a problem of normal common functionals, adiabatic LDA, GGAs, and so on. Okay. Now I'm going to show you an analysis of this. And we now go to finite R. So this argument that I gave before was really in the limit, R going to infinity. We now look at large but finite R. And we make a slightly non-allowed replacement, namely, those are now kind of molecular orbitals, orbitals of that whole system. Still this term. Now I'm going to show you an argument that I think was first given by Barnes. If we then write this excitation energy coming from TDDFT in the so-called single pole approximation, this is what you get. And then you see immediately, since phi A lives on atom A, phi B on atom B, this product here is exponentially small, right? Likewise here. So to get anything finite, like a 1 over capital R behavior, this exchange correlation kernel would have to be exponentially large. It has to increase. Otherwise, this whole thing just doesn't contribute at all. So to reproduce this, and that was the claim by Barents, I think, and I was convinced that this is correct for a long time, is that you need really a fancy functional to give this. Otherwise, and of course it cannot be exponentially increasing everywhere, so it has to have this very tricky frequency dependence, such that at the frequency of this charge transfer excitation, there it has to increase exponentially as a function of R and R prime, but otherwise it has to be benign.
But there is no Hartree interaction, only
delta C. Yeah, that drops out anyways in that limit. One has to, yeah, in principle it's there, but one can see it drops out. Okay, so, I mean, you see it. If this gives a contribution, since this is exponentially small and this one too, and here you have a bare Coulomb term, that's the Hartree part, right? Immediately see it gives zero because it's exponentially small. Right? It goes, behaves like e to the minus capital R. You immediately see it. And you're right. In principle, this term is there. We have fxe plus 1 over r minus r prime. Right?
Now, can you in an expression about, you know, phi e squared interaction with phi b squared, this is not taking this big.
Yeah, no, this is something else. This is the direct Coulomb interaction.
Yes, direct Coulomb interaction. But that's missing somehow in
the
expression.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No direct Coulomb interaction.
Yeah, it has to come in through the kernel. Exactly.
I see. Yeah.
Yeah.
sure that probably everybody else knows this, but as you go back to the page before, what changes if you write the infinite in here as the homo of D minus?
You could write it in this way. It's perfectly legitimate.
Does the argument change in any way?
No. No. Well, it's right what you say. You could write it in that way. This is just a side remark. It's not important for the rest, but it's...
This phi kind of changes as well somehow.
You're right. This whole thing could be identified with the homo of the n plus 1 atom B. Could be written that way. That's true. But the rest remains the same. I mean, this remains the same. Just you would represent that guy in a different way. That's possible. Okay. So the conclusion from this argument would be that on one hand, you need a VXC that has the proper discontinuity and an FXC that has this exponentially strong behavior. However, there was a little glitch in this argument, namely at some point we identified these atomic HOMO and LUMO orbitals referring to atom A and B. We referred those to the molecular orbital energies. And at any finite R, those depend on R as well. And in fact, there's a recent interesting paper by Andy Girling, who seems to have found that actually it is this term that gives the 1 over R behavior, or at least part of this 1 over R behavior. So this is just a side remark. But to capture this behavior, this missing 1 over R behavior, is still kind of difficult in the context of TDDFT. There is advanced functionals, range-separated hybrids, and things that seem to get something of it. Kieron has had some discussions with the people that have developed this. But okay, so what I wanted to focus, this is just an introduction to what I'm going to show now, which then has a relation to what I said before with this oscillations. And the relation is that a charge transfer between distant donor and acceptor is actually never done in nature by a dipole transition, because the numerator of the response function is essentially zero. In an actual experiment, the charge really goes through a solvent or through the molecule, so it's inherently a nonlinear process. Right? So one could argue a much more realistic description of such a charge transfer excitation would really be by propagating the time-dependent Cohn-Sham equations in real time. And then one may wonder whether this problem that we are not able to describe it will show up as well, and in which way it will show up, and so on.
What do you mean by R bar, R bar?
As far as you like. That is the limiting case that I have discussed. But in real molecules, actually, you need not go so far. Yeah, then.
But your point is that there's some chain of matter in reality between the two.
Yeah. Still, if these donor and acceptor orbitals are well defined, and this is the chemist's thinking of this, then if you have such a process, the electron somehow goes through the solvent. Right? It's not that it's a laser-induced dipole transition. So let's describe that by time propagation. And the example is H2 plus, as I announced already. And just propagate with the simplest functional time-dependent adiabatic LFDA and see what comes out. So, and to make it even simpler, this is a one-dimensional representation of the problem. It's soft Coulomb potentials that are plotted here. And you have a gerade and ungerade solution in the ground state. And from those, you can form these linear combinations, psi g minus psi u, which lives on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, orbital psi g plus psi u. Right? And if you propagate now the exact time-dependent one electron Schrödinger equation, and start, let's say, on the left-hand side with this psi left orbital, propagate, then you see an oscillation. This is the period of the oscillation. So what is plotted here is the expectation value of x as a function of time. So it starts on the left-hand side and then goes to the right-hand side and oscillates forever. And physical picture, one could associate it with tunneling, right? It goes from one side to the other, tunnels from one side to the other and back. So, and now is the quiz. Now we do this with TDDFT. So our approximation is the time-dependent LDA, and we start on the left-hand side, and we propagate. What do you think will come out? What's your guess?
No self-interaction correction.
Self-interaction correction for this one electron problem would lead back to the exact problem.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's why I wrote this here. So exact, in this case, is identical with time-dependent exact exchange and is also identical with time-dependent SIC. So that's, in that sense, for these approximations, you get the exact result. But just the non-SIC corrected LSDA. What do you think will be the result?
Possibly much too high.
Mm-hmm. That was my guess also before we did the calculation. Yeah, that's a good guess. So this is the result. In fact, the particle stays on the left-hand side. It wobbles around a little bit, but just stays there.
I probably lost the coupling of the orbitals, right? So.
Yeah, you could say so. The point is actually quite simple. If you think of the initial density, which is localized on the left-hand side, if you then plot the Cohn-Chern potential, the initial Cohn-Chern potential also has a well on the left-hand side. So it just stays in that well. Oh. It wobbles around a bit, but doesn't get you anywhere.
Well, yes. I mean, that was the basis of what I said, was the Hartree potential would outweigh the exchange correlation potential, so it would be the opposite. Mm-hmm.
Is that usual for the negative VXC to be larger than the positive Hartree?
No.
It's one electron.
In general, that's not the case. It's for one electron, I guess. In fact, if you compare, if you just take the initial Kohn-Chern potential and keep that fixed, so don't change it in time, and propagate with that initial orbital in that fixed potential, and you get something, very similar. So that's this. Okay, so that is something I wanted to.
But if you look at the three-dimensional H plus, then the left-hand side is next to the light vision. Doesn't that behave more normally? So the will outweigh the LVA exchange correction.
Not for one electron, I think. In fact, we did it 3D as well, mm-hmm. And it's the same story. So it's not tied to the dimensionality, but it's tied to the particular particle number. So
the LVA Kohn-Chern eigenvalue of the hydrogen is more negative than 7.6.
So the message is also, so I have not really analyzed here.
An attractive Kohn-Chern potential really going to keep you on your graph forever because you already have an attractive nucleus. So the attractive Kohn-Chern potential itself.
Well, the point is that you have this oscillation. The oscillation is a feature of the of the fact that you have an exact degeneracy, so to say. And that, you don't have that anymore with that,
let's say. No.
And of course, as soon as the potential itself is itself time-dependent, right, which it is in time-dependent Kohn-Chern, all these arguments with tunneling or so, it's a bit problematic. One can only analyze it with a true static potential.
Isn't Paul saying that because in a real molecule the potential goes down to minus infinity, and however low your eigenvalue on the left, there's always a spot on the right, even if it's quite a narrow region, that has the same energy. So you start to get something into that region.
You need symmetry, you need to have the two levels and almost exactly the same spot, right, exactly the same energy, right, spot means energy. Then the degeneracy splits them this tiny amount, which tells you that they were at almost, if you move one relative to the other just a tiny bit, it'll all go to one or the other, and that sort of stays in one side. So it has to be precisely, almost exactly degenerate in order to get the oscillation.
How do I understand this in terms of this delocalization here? I have a problem with it. If you have a hydrogen class, if you stretch it,
You have a continuum on the other side. Then you have many states. But here you have on the other side, students. Then they'll come.
intersects my problem as proton candidate in biology, then I have a problem practice with barriers. So this also doesn't match my motion mechanics one lecture, I think. But anyway, maybe not, but I thought that the Hartree function.
Don't quite see your argument.
I'm a little bit, I don't know. So you construct your initial state. Is this actually the ground state? It's not the ground state.
No.
So, but you have, you make a superposition of degenerate states which are each of them is a ground state.
No, one is ground state.
Ah, okay.
Okay,
so it's
like.
No, and so they are not degenerate states.
I'm not so sure, actually. I mean, isn't the consequence of what you're saying that, in fact, the idea of the symmetry broken state is the ground state?
Not, no. Ground state is always symmetric, but there's a tiny gap. Do we have
symmetric?
Or
didn't you say we are degenerate two states?
Ground state always has symmetry.
So there's two states, right? One is the gerade state and the other one is the ungerade state. They're not degenerate.
They are degenerate.
They're not degenerate.
They're not degenerate.
They're not degenerate. The gerade state is the ground state, the lowest energy is eight, and the ungerade is slightly higher.
But that argument is based on one electron picture. That's a self-consistency.
There's only one electron here.
There is a self-consistency. So the self-consistency.
I think we're cross purposes.
What I'm pointing out is that within the LBA, the ground state is a symmetry state.
No. I don't think so. Well, those are the states that I think I plotted here on the next one.
Yeah, no, I
was
wondering
that question.
Right, it's even free electron.
Mm.
I'm not sure. Too interested to dwell on it because it's clearly
a physical. No, it is important. So you're suggesting that a spatially symmetry program. Solution might have lower energy requirement to be spatially symmetric. Exactly analogous to the H2 problem.
What happens if you just develop a RDA just talking?
You didn't try. I don't know.
Maybe we have an artificial self interaction there. If you have a hydrophobic infusion, there are no electrons around the domain, you cancel each other.
Mm-hmm.
If you just throw hydrogen,
then
that's
exactly what I'm saying. Sure. Then you have a huge amount of potential there, and then they can oscillate back and forth like mad, unless the Fock term does something. My suspicion was that the Fock term does something in this propagation. It might be completely wrong. So, it was certainly completely wrong. But that's what I thought at first.
Mm.
So
physical activity. Where is the hope? Is this now related to this charge transfer problem?
Well, in a way it is. I mean, you, how exactly it is related and the features of the approximate functional, that is another question. I don't know. That still remains to be analyzed. But one might think, okay, we have this 1 over R charge transfer problem in linear response to the DFT, and one might have hoped, well, let's just do a time propagation and the problem is gone. But at least what this shows is that there's also problems. How and whether they are related is not analyzed yet. It's just food for thought. I think the ground state is symmetric. I think so. Yeah, but that's 2 electrons.
Yeah. Or H2 plus. Does it go to 2 high or 2 low? Because if it's 2 high, then break the cylinder. You get exactly a high electron energy.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. But I have a feeling it's too low. Yes. And that's so why
this is simply because the N minus 1 N plus 1 total energy volume is curved, but this, that's how you get the problem. I think this is really Wei Tao Yang's plot number 1 in his NPS talk. And the other papers.
So, Kieran. You mentioned, how was that, anti-adiabatic or upside down adiabatic that solves the problem?
Yes.
Well, show us.
It's for H2 because it's
okay.
We got 10 minutes. So let me do it in 10 minutes. So this was work I did about 5 years ago, but didn't quite finish writing the paper. And then a little while later, these guys from Irvine called, and things got busy, so the paper got put in a drawer, which all got moved and stuff. And then a student of mine, Zhenfei Lu, finished it off just recently. And this summer in Paris, I was visiting Paola Gori Giorgi and Andrea Savin, and she started showing me some results, which were this paper, which catalyzed Zhenfei into finishing our work and them into finishing theirs. And, you know, it's funny because we sort of made this paper was a prediction of what you would do, if you could do certain calculations. And they were doing those calculations. And they did what we predicted they would do, except we didn't predict what they would do because I never wrote up the paper. And that paper appeared a month ago in PhysRev Letters, and is even an editor's choice, right? So there's some moral in there somewhere, right? Send the papers in when they're hot. But in any event, I mean, the important thing, this is actually their work in the sense that the paper that I had written was based on the work of her and Mike Seidel, who had been doing this thing for, Mike has been doing it for 15 years, I think, so. And obviously, somewhat independent. Okay. So the basic thing is, so Mike Seidel was trained as a semi-classical guy and has this idea, which he's pursued for a long time, of what are called strictly correlated electrons. So this isn't strongly correlated, and it's not statically correlated, it's strictly correlated. And all it is you think of this, so there's this adiabatic connection formula in TD in DFT, right, where you write EXC as equal to this integral over a coupling constant. I guess they often use W of lambda. And this coupling constant is a little different from many body theory because you make the potential function of lambda such that the density is held fixed, right? And at lambda equals 0, this is the Cohn-Chan potential. Lambda equals 1, it's the real potential. And I guess, was it Harris first wrote down an approximate form of this? And then David and Bengt and John Perdue. And who was on the paper with Bengt? Ole Gunnarsson sort of wrote down exact versions, which we now use, 76. So yeah, that's the way we normally think of this problem. But Mike has been studying the case when lambda goes to infinity. So they are very correlated electrons, right? You're looking at what happens when the interaction between the electrons are very big. But you know, you'd have a Coulomb explosion and stuff like that if you did that in many body perturbation theory, but it's with this restriction that the density is fixed. And it turns out you can solve this sort of problem, but only in very simple cases do they know. Well, now they can do, I think, any sphere. They started out with sort of, so these are called strictly correlated. So in the interest of time, I'll just say, so today they can do, they do spherical atoms. And the reason you do that is because of the very high symmetry, and you can sort of use that to solve. So you can actually solve this problem under, you know, very severe conditions. And they have beautiful pictures. And what happens, let's say, in helium is if this is my minus 2 over R, I imagine I have one electron here. And the electrons, of course, are very highly localized because of this very strong repulsion. And then on the opposite side, there will be a unique point. So if this is at R1, R2 is a function of R1, which minimizes the total total potential energy, because the kinetic energy is irrelevant, such that it reproduces the exact density of the system. So over many years, they figured out how to do this, and it's really cute. Right? I mean, that's really neat.
So is the idea that each electron is completely localized but has a pair of it sort of whizzing around?
So what it is it's the pair correlation function that once I know where this guy is, the complete localization occurs if you have free minimization, right? If you take a Hooke's atom thing and make the spring constant very small, that's what you get. But here, I mean, you think of it as if, say, this were localized, then this guy, so if you could pin this guy down, then you, this guy is completely localized to this one point. And then you go around distributing this guy so that you get the right density, right? And once you figure out this relation and you can write down a differential equation for this function, boom, you have the energy when lambda goes to infinity. Now, why don't...
Physical picture is exactly what Rick says, right? It's the air that is whizzing around,
so to say. Yeah, but
yes. You're thinking of the one. I said it a little wrong the first time.
Whizzing around all
the time. Exactly. So I think, although I don't know that they explicitly say this, it's sort of like having a delta function in the pair correlation function. Right? Okay.
In that limit, the airplane can hardly move, right? Maybe they move a little bit, the energy will be too high.
Well, no. I mean, what it is that as one electron moves, all the others must move in sync with it. If they don't, then the energy gets very high. But the one electron can move and they all move together. So it's hence strictly correlated, right? It's really, really cute.
It's like a single photon. It just happens to be located in two places.
Yeah. So exactly. So hence it was easy to do two in a spherical situation. It's just one differential equation. And you get
what is the physical situation where you really encounter strictly correlated?
I'll get to that. But now they do the atoms, and what it is you can do, you know, neon, let's say, with five different electrons, you have a shell, and one electron is one shell, and then it's like a beta ansatz kind of thing, right, where they can't cross the shells because of the strict correlation. You divide up into sectors, so they can do it with, I think, five different coordinates. So, years go by and they figure these things out. So what we did was ask the question, well, let's say you could solve that problem routinely on your computer for silicon and stuff, right, for a real system. What could you then do? How would it be helpful, right? And so what ended up coming out was the following thing, where instead of so the adiabatic connection, you put the lambda in front of, so this comes from T plus lambda VEE plus V lambda, right? This is the many body, this is the one body piece. That's the many body Hamiltonian as a function of lambda to do this job. Instead, we wipe out this guy and we'll put a mu here and a mu squared in front of T. You do the adiabatic connection on the kinetic energy instead of the potential energy. Now, it turns out, after you fool around with all the stuff and all that, you end up with the exact formulas come out to be sort of the same, right? As they must. And in that sense, you would gain nothing. So what you're going to do now, though, is write that the energy, right, is equal to the energy of strictly correlated electrons plus now let's call it WDC adiabatic connection integrand, and of course. I'm not sure if in the paper what D... No, I think it's written into the paper. This is the decorrelation energy, right? Because you're starting from... So mu equals zero is simply related to lambda equals infinity, right? It's not quite the same. There's various factors of lambda and so forth, but, it can't be any different. And then mu equals one is the real system. So this is saying, you solve your strictly correlated thing, and then how do you go backwards and deduce the total energy of the real system? And so we do this. Now, it turns out, and this thing here is then turns out to be a derivative, of, I don't have the paper in front of me, so it's related to the kinetic energy. But I think there's a mu to the three halves or something like this. You get funny powers of mu in various places, but it's the kinetic energy as a function of mu instead of the electron-electron repulsion, right? So one of the things that turns out to be the case is this doesn't look, for regular systems, this does not look as useful as this one, because these numbers are substantially bigger. This decorrelation energy is quite a lot. And, you know, that means you've got to approximate a big thing, right? So back then, sort of made simple approximations and so forth. So what Paola, that's Paola Gori Giorgi and Mike Seidel and Giovanni Vignale wrote this FISREV letter. What they did, in fact, was write down, you know, a few simple approximations for two electron systems where they were getting reasonably accurate results, but, you know, the generality, et cetera, right? But they demoed that you could do a pretty good job doing this kind of thing, whereas we were just sort of suggesting the general framework. The thing that we were focused on is the fact that, you know, you make certain, people make approximations, like say a linear one of the lambda dependence of this guy. It's quite popular in chemistry and stuff these days. And then you can do the integration and so forth. If you make a linear approximation here, you get a very different result. So all the tricks and games and things that people play can be played again here, and they give different answers, right? Even though if you do the exact treatment, you always get the exact answer, right? Same as any place. So how is this related to our H2 problem? Well, you can check, right? But as you see, you know, when you stretch your H2, your electrons become strictly correlated. Because it turns out that this will, you know, equal to what happens to your adiabatic connection curve. So here's 0. And, well, we'll put 1 here, right? And we all see these kinds of curves. So this would be at R equals, you know, whatever, R0, I guess, 0.75 angstroms, right? And then if I stretch H2, so this is W of lambda. If I stretch it to 5 angstroms, it looks like this. I did this, well, Martin Fuchs did this calculation.
Because there was a change in this graph just within the last week. Somebody, right at the start of their talk.
Oh, Philip.
Philip, yes.
Yes. It's basically a Purdue cartoon from way back, which has now been, you know, calculated and so forth. Actually, I had a very funny experience with this graph because I was in Belgium at Abinitz, Xavier Gons's place, and I was talking about adiabatic connections, and I put up this picture. And for H2, a bond, regular bond length, and at 5 angstroms. And, you know, I come to the end of the talk, and every single person has only one question about all the stuff I said, which was, how did you, you know, they're all sort of talking among themselves, how did you calculate that picture? And I said, oh, it's just a cartoon. Well, what I had done was I had reverse engineered the picture, because a quantum chemical calculation gives me an accurate EC. I could figure out an accurate TC, and I could, you know, with a simple parameterization, figure out the curve. But there, for the it never happened to me before, because then they said, well, we've been trying to do these calculations. And so Martin Fuchs started, like an hour later, this calculation, and it ran for, I think, 36 hours, and it came out almost right on top of my cartoon. the cartoon was right. So Anyway, so it gets flatter and flatter, right? So this, of course, is the thing that you need. This is W infinity, which gives you your strictly correlated thing. They become, it isn't that they're really strictly correlated, it's that the difference, this decorrelation energy, becomes very small. You know, they aren't strictly correlated, but the deviation from strict correlation becomes very small.
I have a comment. I think that people have done this kind of thing in the context of Harvard model, because strong carbon naming. I think the Harvard model also describes this situation very in chin. When the separation becomes large, then the U is much larger than T, the Hopping pyramid.
Yes,
so
yes.
That's the situation.
Yes.
Here. They just expand this T. They take the higher U limit and expand T. And T is smaller.
Yeah. Like a Hubbard model is, if nothing goes funny because of the, you know, the using of sites rather than real space, you know, you should get exactly the same kind of thing. That's right. Subject to the complications we've been talking about. Anyhow, so yeah, so you know. Okay, you can only do spherical atoms, but the point is, when things are strongly correlated, they are closer to strictly correlated than they are to the weak correlation, and they're not anymore sort of around here. It's a way of picking up what's going on there. And they sent me a recent preprint now in which they even made the lambda negative, which is scary, right? Truly scary, because then they have attractive forces between the electrons. But you know, you can sort of make sense out of it and stuff. I don't think I read it.
Wouldn't make part of yourself any weirder.
So, of course, the Thornton operator, I was coming from a half a million to this concept, but if that's not in there, that makes no sense whatsoever. But the other result is this not really, it doesn't have to be a property of the starting point, right? Because if you think about it in terms of the simple property, you start with a density completely on one side, and there's really nothing to propagate. Right?
For a while, I thought it has to do with this initial state dependence.
Yeah, exactly. Because if you have nothing, if you have zero to propagate, even if you go down the slope, there is nothing to propagate. This is not the case.
So, I think it is the case. This is one part.
Because as soon as you put some kind of density over there, it will grow, and the other one will shrink. Mm-hmm. Especially if the ground state is misdependent, which has to be.
Well, but the H2 plus the cone sham potential is always the same. So it doesn't show any initial state dependence. But then if you divide it up, in this case, the LDA potential is pathological. The LDA potential is pathological in this sense.
But if you start with a high density over here and low density over there, then the propagator is going to shift them. Because they're going to go through the energy minimum. And then back.
No, what happens is it just doesn't transfer from one side to the other, even if you have a bit.
But can miraculously transfer downwards? What tunneling usually does? I mean, it's going to transfer you from one.
But tunneling is turned off because your potential is not symmetric, basically.
This is what I think.
the electron here, it's still going to tunnel through there. But you start with the
well, what do you mean by a ground state that's there?
They're going to have a common ground state left, and it's found potential.
Hold on. I mean, are you saying there's a level here and a level, you know, that if you do these separately, so then there's just one state. So how can you put it on one side? No.
As long as there's.
I mean, if there's only one state, then. I mean, the case is when you have a double well potential that's symmetric, and then.
People still have one state that has a.
Well, then you're not in this situation that Hardy's talking about, which is when they're sort of sufficiently separated so that if you have something like this, if you separate them in the normal way, then this barrier gets bigger. And the thing is, you get zero occupation over here and all occupation over there.
But the barrier is not infinite.
No, but I mean, it becomes exponentially small. If they don't match, if it's not symmetric.
But if you have a potential with two barrels, there's a barrier between all of the potential looks. There's only one Schrodinger equation that describes both, as long as there's one infinite barrel.
The point is, there's no level there. If it's like this, right, and there's a decent barrier between them, there's still only one state, but it's, you know, almost entirely localized.
Yeah, but now you've drawn it such that, for example, there's a state that only has a potential on one side. That's fine.
That's just solving the Schrodinger equation for this well. I don't get to choose, right? If that's the shape of the well, that's what happens.
Sure. But if it's certainly well is significantly closer, then you'll get a state that has a potential probability.
But that's not Hardy's situation, right? That's the point. The well is either sufficiently high or sufficiently wide. That's the limit he's interested in. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, so when things are not symmetric, then they're not almost degenerate. We're into our topic. Yeah, but this is crucial to the question.
Crucial to the question.
Yeah.
And we'll
quit.
In what sense is now the stretched H2 wired in electrons strictly correlated? Because they cannot jump from one side to the other?
I was just thinking that as I was saying. They're not strictly correlated. It's that the decorrelation energy has become very small. Let me think about it for a second because I hadn't thought of that before. What it must be is that the strictly correlated state is degenerate with the actual Heitler-London wave function, which is the ground state of the separated H2s. It isn't that it is the wave function, it's that it's degenerate with it as the thing becomes large. And so that's why this decorrelation. I mean, so the decorrelation energy for any finite R is finite, which is telling you that the strictly correlated state is not the ground state, but it's becoming arbitrarily close in energy, and therefore it's good enough, right? I mean, that's, you know, for practical purposes, it means this is now a good starting point. But it doesn't mean it's the exact wave function. I don't think it is. But that's what you want, right? A good starting point and a small correction. So if I said so they're strictly correlated, that isn't right. It's not there. Arbitrarily close to the strictly correlated energy.
Why is it
energy
closer when you move them apart? Because they...
Well, what happens is this thing drops very, very rapidly because of the degeneracy, because the gap is becoming very small, so you get this very rapid drop in this curve. And it's because what that means is that the kinetic energy is almost zero, the kinetic contribution to the correlation energy. so that's why. I mean, if I over cookies, we can figure out a more physical way of saying that. But I mean, it's all, those things are all true. I don't know if the, if it does it for you, right?
The whole lambda dependence in this coupling constant representation comes from the fact that you have a kinetic contribution in your relation. If you did, that's the matrix function theory, where you have the kinetic energy is active, corresponding to the strange correlation, and it just scales linearly. So that, that there is no coupling constant representation, or there is one, but it's really, it's constant. So exactly what you said, as the kinetic contribution becomes negligible, then it should be straight.
Yeah, well, you're right, but of course, it's never actually straight, right? For a finite R, there's a finite drop and stuff, right? And so that's what I'm saying, it's not the actual ground state. But that doesn't matter, you get the right energy. And for the right reason, spare me. Okay, so I guess we have our last coffee.
Can I suggest that before we break up, we should thank very much the organizers, present and
present and moved on.
having not only having set this whole thing up in a very nice way for us on paper, especially especially for establishing an atmosphere and encouraging us to keep an atmosphere where we have felt informal, where we've had plenty of time to discuss things. It's really been very reminiscent of some very good a very good environments that I'm sure we've all been in the past, and very, very
helpful for us all.
The good old days, exactly.
Whether real or imaginary.
So, thank you very much from me, and I'm sure from all of us.
Thank you guys, because you are the survivors, right? The best to stay to that very end of the program. So with that, we're done.
No, really, come on. Yeah. We want some more.
Good reading papers, man.